WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Vincent Cunningham, and I'll be sitting in today for David Remnick. Thanks for joining me. Hands down, one of the standout TV shows of the last year was HBO's Watchmen. It's been nominated for 26 Emmy Awards, which is an amazing number. Watchmen was adapted from a cult classic 80s graphic novel about American politics, vigilantism, and war. It's a superhero story, but at the heart of this new version is a horror that's totally real. The Greenwood Massacre, a rampage against the black community of Tulsa a century ago that left hundreds of people dead. The thing about Watchmen is how it brings this very difficult history together with the sheer badass fun of fantasy.
Cavalry's back. No. 3 years of peace. And we convinced ourselves that they were gone. But they were just hibernating. Good thing we know where their caves are.
That tension shows up on every level of the show, and definitely in its wide-ranging score. Watchmen's music is sometimes creepy, sometimes mournful, and sometimes outrageous. It's not just a mood setter, it's like its own character. The score is by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and it was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards. You might know Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross as the 2 permanent members of the industrial rock band Nine Inch Nails. In recent years, they've also composed music for films like Bird Box and Gone Girl, and their score for The Social Network won the Oscar. They worked with creator Damon Lindelof, who also created Lost, to score Watchmen. I talked last week with Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor.
We were drawn primarily to Damon, and not knowing him as a person, we just respect the work he's done. I think what he's done in television has been groundbreaking. When I heard he was interested in Watchmen, and I got wind of his affinity for the material, it seemed like something that could go wrong so easily that I know he's going to approach that with everything he's got. And what we found was exactly what we'd hoped it would be. It's a shame it's only one season. it felt like a new home.
Right. If I imagine how you write a TV score, you're setting yourself in a world, you have major characters, you're exploring that world through sound, but Watchmen has like a million characters and it takes place in like 4 or 5 different worlds and all the stories are very complicated. So I found myself wondering as I watched again, listening to what you had done, where do you start with something as sprawling as this?
The new thing that was presented to us on this project, being my first foray into television, was the, you know, if it's a film, generally you know how it's going to end. Mm-hmm. You've read the script or there is a script. You have a couple hours usually to tell the story, and one as a composer can start to think about it in its entirety, what It's the shape of this thing. What connective threads could there be? What bookendish qualities to the score might one consider when approaching? This was different. Where what did we know? We knew it was 9 hours, okay? And we have the script for the first one.
Right.
And we have a very vague understanding of what might happen throughout the course of the season, with major points omitted in that description to us. And they weren't finished writing it yet. I mean, I'm assuming it was planned out, but we didn't have access to that. So we didn't know what the ending was. We didn't know exactly where it wound up. We didn't know that there would be, we'd be revisiting several different time periods in genre.
Yeah, I mean, you could read the script, but you didn't really get it until you got the picture. And then, I mean, the two things that struck me when we got there were two cuts of the episode one. The second one was, one, this is really important, and two, it's simultaneously important and engaging in a kind of fun would sound like not the right word to use, but there is an energy about it, and that Damon wanted the music to be a character. And particularly in episode one, it felt like we were being let off the leash in a way that we hadn't previously been, in the sense that we were able to dip into the toolkit that we might use in aspects of in Nine Inch Nails. But it was also an education as well. You know, I mean, the whole process of Watchmen was, but looking back at Watchmen, I can't really think of anything else apart from Watchmen. I mean, it was a wholly immersive experience for however long we were on that, which is a blur.
I'm glad you mentioned the pilot, because there's a song from that episode that's nominated for an Emmy. The song's called Objects in Mirror Are Closer Than They Appear, and it runs through a series of scenes. It kind of goes from an interrogation room with the character Looking Glass all the way to this shootout that happens on a cattle farm.
Well, we looked at that really as a suite of music.
How long have you lived in Tulsa?
Six.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
You know, one knew it needed to be propulsive and engaging, and we had some idea of the backdrop of the shots that were being shown at the time. And it was really just kind of punctuation to Looking Glass's questions, and knowing that this piece was going to need to build and build and build and build and build.
Are you a member of, or do you associate with, members of the white supremacist organization known as the 7th Cavalry?
No.
Up until we arrive, Angela takes off at the cattle battle is when we switch music.
Mm-hmm. Like what Atticus was saying earlier, once we realize they want to play music in the forefront, and they want to, as Atticus said, treat music as a character, then we were faced with, particularly in this first episode, now there's 6 and 7, 8 minute chunks of music. It almost plays like a music video with action behind it. Then it quickly becomes, all right, how can we pace this so that it still can step up in ways? It's not all about fast tempo, and it's not all about gun battle excitement. How can we stretch this out and manipulate the release so that when it comes, you can't wait for that musically to help achieve that.
Cop got shot, so we're all a little wound up here. But still, that's no excuse for how I treated you. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Appreciate your understanding.
And I think in the one you're talking about now, it starts with an interrogation, which we love the idea of it being almost kind of raunchy feeling and kind of sexy in a weird way with his images, and it was shot in such an interesting way that we felt that music amplified the disoriented nature of that whole scene. The choice then, as they've got the information from him, and now they're about to go into a shootout, what if we try to keep the tempo the same through this whole long chunk?
Cattle ranch.
And we then started experimenting with different ways we could flip that groove on its head and keep the tempo the same. So it still has a halftime kind of nod your head feel, but it suddenly gets much darker and unpleasant. We bring in the distorted bass. And next thing, during the shootout, we were surprised, pleasantly surprised, to see that we could make that feel exciting and violent and overwhelming without having to speed up to double speed, without bringing in drums of war and other mechanisms that would be corny. You know?
Down, down, everybody down!
So we were learning through that whole process, and it was cool to see. We kind of went from feeling like our role as the composer is going to be, you know, gently filling in some blanks here and there to, okay, it's a featured music. 20 minutes of the show is, you know, go. All right, let's make sure we do that with taste and restraint and knowing when to put our foot on the gas and when to kind of let the picture pick up.
But it was a very exciting experience because of the pace of TV and because of what we were being challenged to do musically.
Sure.
But it was also a kind of, I don't know what the right word is, you know, I know that we didn't want to, we were not going to let the show down, because it was clear that this one matters. This one really does matter.
Yeah. Can you name a moment during this process where you got the assignment from Damon and it just was totally intimidating? Felt like something you just couldn't deliver.
Well, I can tell you one easy one was the reveal of Dr. Manhattan, Life on Mars.
Right. Song by David Bowie.
Yeah. To me, that's one of the greatest songs ever recorded. If I had to just pick, if I had to go to a desert island and only allowed to take one person, it would be David Bowie, no question. So, to me, that's sacred ground. And I think both of us were intimidated. And when we finished it, we were like, I don't know if we've done it justice. I don't know if it's, we didn't know. And I can, and this is true. We were like, I don't think we should put it on one of the albums. Like, one of the things that me and Trent have in common is that, you know, we're not like the most secure people. In like, I know I can look back on Watchmen and say we did the best that we can do, and I can look back on everything that we've done and say that. But when it leaves the studio, at the end of, you know, episode X or Y, we're not at the end of the episode slapping each other on the back, going, "Man, we knocked that out the park." You know, we're just not like that. And on the David Bowie cover, now I can listen to it, and I really like it. I love it. But it was almost like I needed the validation of the few friends that I do have, getting a text message from them saying, "Man, loved the end of episode 7. Love the version that you did." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like,
shamefully it. I agree.
So there you go.
Very cool.
You know, the thing about music I found, just to ramble on for a second, is...
No, please.
The more you do it, the more I feel like there's so much more to know. there's never a sense of mastery. There's feelings. I can have the feeling that I'm good at this thing I know how to do. But what's I found endlessly engaging about composing, and what's been great about having an alternate career in scoring, is that you're constantly reminded of how powerful and beautiful music, and how emotionally direct, you know, and it can affect people in ways I don't think anything else can, and memory and experience, and it's invigorating to kind of see, for as much as you know, there's that much more to know, and it keeps it exciting, you know.
Thank you both so much. This has been awesome.
No, thank you. Feeling is mutual.
Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. They're nominated for 2 Emmy Awards for the music for the series Watchmen on HBO. I'm Vincent Cunningham, and we'll be back with more.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
From the New Yorker Radio. A year ago, August of 2019, we lost one of the greats. Toni Morrison was 88, the author of 11 novels and many other works. People of my generation first encountered Morrison in our high school English classes. She was a legend by then, and her books helped us to see not only how rich and satisfying literature could be, but also how varied and strange our own lives could be. She revealed the history of slavery as a kind of haunting. She investigated new and freakish ways of seeing. She showed us how dangerous it could be to be alienated from the past. Morrison once said, "We don't need any more writers as solitary heroes. We need a heroic writer's movement. Assertive, militant, pugnacious. She did more than most to build that kind of broad, loving community, but she was a hero too. Toni Morrison spoke with my colleague, staff writer Hilton Alls, in 2015. It was a few months after her last novel, God Help the Child, was published.
Takes place in the so-called contemporary world.
Yeah.
How was that for you?
Scary. I started God Bless the Child. Mm-hmm. And I started Home and finished it. Mm-hmm. And because that was a period that I could sort of understand. I couldn't write about now, I felt, because it was so slippery. Until I realized that what was very definitive about now is so powerfully, powerfully self-referential. Mm-hmm. Novels about me, stories about me. And I thought, okay, if she becomes this glamorous creature, it will be in cosmetics, which is all about beauty and looking good and, you know, so on. And for him, it would be hanging on to the absence of his older brother. So he leaves and he goes away to college and nothing is satisfactory. Mm-hmm. He's better than everything. He's going to write the great books. He's going to do, you know, he doesn't do any of it. He can't even play a decent horn. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he plays a little bit, but nobody takes him that seriously. So he's cutting himself off at the leg because he's hanging on to, you know, this, what about me and how I feel.
Right.
So the coming together, when somebody can listen to a conversation between these two people and they can listen to each other and know that there's something valuable that they need in the other person. Mm-hmm. And that's a good ending.
When you talk about that idea of me and selfies and all of that, that noise, let's say, that doesn't exist in other centuries or other times, were you distracted by the reality of now before you could tell the story?
You know, I always say, you know, remember when I was a girl, a young girl, we were called citizens, American citizens. American citizens that. We were second-class citizens, but that was the word. And then after World War II in the 50s and 60s, they started calling us consumers. The American consumer needs or should or meh. And so we did, consume. Now, they don't use those words anymore. Listen, the American taxpayer. And those are different attitudes. If you're a citizen, you think your block or your neighbors or your town or something is part of you. If you're a consumer, you just go to the store and shop. That's a whole different thing.
Yes.
So that's part of what I was feeling. But generally speaking, when I was writing God Bless the Child, that's what I thought was distinctive, you know, about the period. I want to tell you what the title of that book was before I was forced to change it. I called it The Wrath of Children.
That's a great title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody hated it.
No.
My agent, my editor, the editor-in-chief, da-da-da-da-da. So this one sounded like Billie Holiday or somebody. You know what I mean? This is great. Thank you.
Toni, I'm going to be like one of those boys in Lorraine getting up. To thank you.
Thanks, darling. It was really lovely.
That's Toni Morrison, who died in August of last year. She spoke in 2015 with The New Yorker's Hilton Alls, and you can hear a much longer version of their conversation at newyorkerradio.org. I'm Vincent Cunningham. thank you for joining us this week. David Remnick will be back with you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.